Captured in a test tube, blood may look like a static liquid, but it's alive, as animate and intelligent as the rest of you. It also makes up a great deal of you. Of your 50 trillion cells, 1/4 are red blood cells. 2 million are born every second. On their way to maturation, red blood cells jettison their nuclei, their DNA, their capacity to divide and repair. They have no future, only a task, to carry the hemoglobin that will hold your oxygen. They don't use the oxygen themselves, they only transport it. This they do with exquisite precision, completing a cycle of circulation through your body every 20 seconds for 100 days. Then they die. The core of hemoglobin is a molecule of iron. It's the iron that grasps the oxygen at the surface of your lungs, hangs on through the rush of blood, and then releases it to wanting cells. If iron goes missing, the body, as ever, has a fallback plan. It adds more water to increase blood volume. Thin blood travels faster through the fine capillaries. Do more with less. All good, except that's less and less oxygen offered to the cells. Another plan kicks in. Increase cardiac output. The heart ups its stroke volume and its rate. To keep you from exploding, the brain joins in, sending signals to the muscles enfolding each blood vessel, telling them to relax. Now blood volume can increase with blood pressure stable. But still, no iron arrives. At this point, the other organs have to cooperate, giving up blood flow to protect the brain and heart. The skin makes major sacrifices, which is why people with anemia are known for their pallor. Symptoms perceived by the person, you, will probably increase as your tissues and then organs begin to starve. If there is no relief, ultimately all the plans will fail. Even a strong heart can only strain for so long. Blood backs up into the capillaries. Under the pressure, liquid seeps out into the surrounding tissues. You are now swelling, and you don't know why. Then the lungs are breached. The alveoli, the tiny sacs that await the promise of air, stiffen from the gathering flood. It doesn't take much. The sacs fill with fluid. Your body is drowning itself. This is called pulmonary edema, and you are in big trouble. I know this because it happened to me. Uterine fibroids wrung a murder scene from me every month. The surgery to remove them pushed me across the red cell Rubicon. I knew nothing. My body understood and responded. My eyes swelled, then my ankles, my calves. Then I couldn't breathe. Then it hurt to breathe. I finally stopped taking advice from my dog. Take a nap, with me! And dragged myself to the ER, where eventually all was revealed. 2 weeks later, the flood had subsided, absorbed back into some wetland tissue of my body, and I felt the absence of pain as a positive. Breathing was exquisite, the sweetest thing I could imagine. Every moment of effortless air was all I could ever want. I knew it would fade and I would forget. But for a few days, I was alive, and it was good. Our bodies are both all we have and everything we could want. We are alive, and we get to be alive. There is joy on the surface of the skin, waiting for sunlight and soft things, both of which produce endorphins. So yes, joy. There is the constant, stalwart sound of our hearts. Babies who are carried against their mother's hearts learn to breathe better than those who aren't. There is the strength of bone and the stretch of muscle and their complex coordination. We are a set of electrical impulses inside a watery environment. How? Well, the nerves that conduct the impulses are sheathed by a fatty substance called myelin. They're insulated. This permits agile communication between distant body parts. Understand this. It's all alive. It all communicates. It makes decisions, and it knows what it's doing. You can't possibly fathom its intricacies. To start to explore the filigree of brain, synapse, nerve, and muscle is to know that even the blink of your eyes is a miracle. Our brains were 2 million years in the making. That long, slow accretion doubled our cranial capacity, and the first thing we did with it was say thank you. We drew the megafauna and the megafemales, sculpted and carved them. The oldest known figurative sculpture is the goddess of Holofels, and 40,000 years ago, someone spent hundreds of hours carving her. There is no mystery here, not to me. The animals and the women gave us life. Of course, they were our first endless art project. Awe and thanksgiving are built into us, body and brain. Once upon a time, we knew we were alive, and it was good. And now we leave the realm of miracles and enter hell. Patriarchy is the ruling religion of the planet. It comes in variations, some old, some new, some ecclesiastical, some secular. But at the bottom, they are all necrophilic. Eric Fromm describes necrophilia as the passion to transform that which is alive into something unalive, to destroy for the sake of destruction, the exclusive interest in all that is purely mechanical. In this religion, the worst sin is being alive, and the carriers of that sin are female. Under patriarchy, the female body is loathsome, its life-giving fat cells vilified, its generative organs despised. Its natural condition is always ridiculed. Normal feet must be turned into 4-inch stubs. Rib cages must be crushed into collapse. Breasts are varyingly too big or too small, or excised entirely. That this inflicts pain, if not constant agony, is not peripheral to these practices. It's central. When she suffers, she is made obedient. Necrophilia is the end point of sadism. The sadistic urge is about control. Quote, the passion to have absolute and unrestricted control over a living being. The objective of inflicting pain and degradation is to break a human being. Pain is always degrading. Victimization humiliates. Eventually, everyone breaks. The power to do that is the sadist dream. And who could be more broken to your control than a woman who can't walk? Some nouns. Glass, scissors, razors, acid. Some verbs. Cut, scrape, cauterize, burn. These nouns and verbs create unspeakable sentences when the object is a 7-year-old girl with her legs forced open. The clitoris, with its 8,000 nerve endings, is always sliced up. In the most extreme forms of genital mutilation, the labia are cut off and the vagina is sewn shut. On her wedding night, the girl's husband will penetrate her with a knife before his penis. You don't do this to a human being. You do it to an object. That much is true. But there is more. Because the world is full of actual objects, cardboard boxes and abandoned cars, and men don't spend their time torturing those. They know we aren't objects, that we have nerves that feel and flesh that bruises. They know we have nowhere else to go when they lay claim to our bodies. That's where the sadist finds his pleasure. Pain produces suffering, humiliation perhaps more, and if he can inflict that on her, it's absolute proof of his control. Behind the sadists are the institutions, the condensations of power that hand us to him. Every time a judge rules that women have no right to bodily integrity, that upskirt photos are legal, that miscarriages are murder, that women should expect to be beaten, he wins. Every time the fashion masters make heels higher and clothes smaller, he wins. Every time an entire class of women, the poorest and most desperate, at the bottom of every conceivable hierarchy, are declared legal commodities for sex, he gets a collective hard-on. Whether he personally uses any such women is beside the point. Society has ruled they are there for him. Other men have ensured their compliance, and they will comply. He can kill one, the ultimate sex act for the sadist, and no one will notice. And no one does. There is no stop to this, no natural endpoint. There is always another sentient, self-willed being to inflame his desire to control. So the addiction is forever fed. With other addictions, the addict bottoms out. His life becomes unmanageable, and the stark choice is stop or die. But the sadist isn't hurting himself. There's no looming bottom to hit, only an endless choice of victims served up by the culture. Women are the feasts at our own funeral, and he is happy to feed. If feminism was reduced to one word, it would be this: no. No is a boundary, spoken only by a self who claims one. Objects have neither. Subjects begin at no. Feminists said no, and we meant it. The boundary of no extended outward, an insult to one being an injury to all. We is the word of political movements. Without it, women are cast adrift in a hostile, chaotic sea, holding our breath against the next bad thing. With the lens of feminism, the chaos snaps into sharp focus. We gave words to the bad things, then faced down denial and despair to see the pattern. That's called theory. Then we demanded remedies. That's what subjects, especially political subjects, do. Emmeline Pankhurst, leader of the British suffragettes, worked at the census office as a birth registrar. Every day, young girls came in with their newborns. Every day, she had to ask who the father was. And every day, the girls wept in humiliation and rage. Reader, you know who the fathers were. That's why Pankhurst never gave up. To say no to the sadist is to assert those girls as political subjects, as human beings with the standing that comes from inalienable rights. Each and every life is self-willed and sovereign. Each life can only be lived in a body, not an object to be broken down for parts, a living body. Child sexual abuse is especially designed to turn the body into a cage. The bars may start as terror and pain, but they will harden to self-loathing. Instilling shame is the best method to ensure compliance. We are ashamed. Sexual violation is very good at that. And for the rest of our lives, we will comply. Our compliance is, of course, his control. His power is his pleasure, and another generation of girls will grow up in bodies they will surely hate to be women who comply. Female socialization is a process of psychologically constraining and breaking girls, otherwise known as grooming, to create a class of compliant victims. Across history, this breaking has included so-called beauty practices, like female genital mutilation and foot binding, as well as the ever-popular child sexual abuse. Femininity is really just the traumatized psyche displaying acquiescence. In its essence, it is ritualized submission. This is not natural. It was not created by God. It's a corrupt and brutal social arrangement. It's become popular to embrace trendy notions from postmodernism in some activist circles. This includes the idea that gender is, quote, a binary. But gender is not a binary. It's a hierarchy, global in its reach, sadistic in its practice, murderous in its conclusion, just like race, just like class. Gender demarcates the geopolitical boundaries of patriarchy. It divides us in half, but it's not a horizontal half. It's vertical. Gender is not some cosmic yin and yang. It's a fist and the flesh that bruises. It's a mouth crushed shut and a girl who will never be the same. Gender is who gets to be human and who gets to be hurt. That has to be made clear because men know exactly what they are capable of. They know. They know the sadism they've built into their own sex. Do it to her, is what they say to each other. Not to me, the human being, but her, the object, the thing. And her has to be obvious, visually and ideologically. See, there she is, unable to walk. See, there she is, on display. Or, there she is, secluded and covered, for your eyes only. And how much easier if he can say, God made her this way, to lie beneath me, and obey. Or nature made her this way, an empty hole. Or her own brain made her this way, the slut who asks for it. Because she asks for all of it. The rape, the battering, the poverty, the prostitution, the murder. Noel Ignatieff, author of How the Irish Became White, has argued for abolishing the white race, defined as, quote, white privilege and race identity. Likewise, the sex class men is simply male privilege and gender identity, and it needs to be abolished if women are ever to be free. If you were born female, you were born on a battlefield. You will be punished for even saying that out loud, but the grim truth is you're going to be punished no matter what for the sin of being female. Battering is the most commonly committed violent crime in the United States. That's a man beating a woman. Men do that every 18 seconds. That's more hatred than I can comprehend. Right now, that battlefield is such a slaughter, we can't even collect our wounded. An example? There are entire villages in India where all the women only have one kidney. That's because their husbands have sold the other one. And there are people who want to argue that gender is some kind of sexy, fun performance or an identity we all get to choose. When all the women have only one kidney, this is not a performance and it's not an identity. It's an atrocious human rights violation against an entire class of people, people called women. And that is the meaning of gender and precisely why it needs to be abolished. Transgender activist Joelle Ruby Ryan has written that the terms female and sex class are, quote, offensive and passé. One might reasonably wonder why Ryan is eager to claim membership in a group so declared, or why Ryan got a job teaching women's studies if female is so offensive. That a biological reality, female, can be called offensive shows how far down the rabbit hole queer theory has fallen. What's next, gravity? But to make sex class a dirty word means that the realities of women's lives become once more unspeakable, each woman isolated in an inchoate anguish. Apply the word sex class, and that isolation snaps into a sharp pattern of subordination. The crimes men commit against women aren't done to women as random individuals. They're done because women belong to a subordinate class, and they're done to keep women a subordinate class. The genderists don't want to resist gender. They are, in fact, quite attached to it. Writes one, quote, "It would be a crying shame if woman and man ceased to be relevant categories for me to play with." Substitute poor and rich, or black and white, and understand that people being oppressed are not categories to be played with. Especially, they are not masturbation fodder. If you understand that, the only question left is, are women people? The strangest part of this whole debate is that feminists are being called, quote, biological essentialists. The genderists posit the immortal, even cosmic nature of femininity. A typical comment, quote, "There is a distinct, substantive, immutable feminine gender, and it cannot be transcended." They baldly state their belief in, quote, brain sex. White supremacists are the only people who believe in the Negro brain, but talk of lady brains is completely accepted across progressive communities if it comes from genderists. Feminists, in contrast, start with Simone de Beauvoir, "One is made, not born a woman." It's that making that we intend to stop. It can be stopped because gender is a social process. It's the genderists who claim it's biological, immutable, yet we get called essentialists. And it's the genderists who conform. For all their talk of gender bending, their goal is cosmetics, costumes, and surgery to match their bodies to gender caricatures. They are permanently altering their bodies, removing healthy organs, and in some cases, the ability to ever experience sexual pleasure again, to better fit a corrupt and brutal arrangement of power. This is now being done to children, and some of the children already regret it. Please read that sentence again. Please. The children should be an alarm call, but no one is listening. There are historical precedents from which left-leaning people should have learned. Much of the progressive movement embraced eugenics, until the optimistic, shiny promise of science produced punctual trains to crematoriums. Similarly, in the 1950s, many liberals believed that chemical castration was the compassionate approach to homosexuality. We look back in bewildered horror, but refuse to see that it's happening now. The unfit are being chemically sterilized once again. People are being surgically mutilated in the service of social conformity. Children as young as 18 months are being diagnosed as transgender. What does that even mean in someone who has yet to speak her first word? She preferred the blue pacifier to the pink? The real question, so what if she did? Girls can't like blue, play rough, take up space, run for president? Apparently not. Free to be you and me through surgery. The prison of gender is locking down ever tighter. And the female body is the cage. Most women are at constant war with their bodies, and it's a war we lose before first grade. 50% of preschool girls think they are too fat. If a girl makes it through that battlefield, with its devastating cultural terrain of dehumanizing and sadistic images, the big guns are waiting. By the time they're 10, 90% of girls have been subjected to unwanted sexual attention by neighborhood boys. By the time they're 11, it's adult men threatening the violations to that same 90%. This is the meaning of female and patriarchy, learned early and often, an object to be publicly used. Get used to it, girls. Meanwhile, eating disorders, the slow, grinding punishment of the female fat cell, have the highest mortality of all mental illness. The most heartbreaking element of the transgender narrative is their hatred of their bodies. In the war between culture and nature, gender and body, the body loses. And that defeat is turned into an identity. The only parallel claim is made by the anorexics pro Annas, who insist their wrenching disjuncture of self and body is a legitimate identity. There is no doubt that people hate their bodies. Willful starvation and surgical mutilation speak with a stark, eloquent evidence. The question is why? Guy Debord wrote presciently of the society of the spectacle, where, quote, being becomes having, and having is reduced to merely appearing. This is, of course, what has happened, and then some. Commodity fetishism has conquered every human relationship, including, finally, that between body and self. Instead of inhabiting, quote, the soft animal of your body, as poet Mary Oliver so sweetly puts it, the body is an object to own, and then to starve or slice until it approximates the punishing, promising image. Our genitals are now a commodity to be obtained rather than tissue to inhabit, the exquisite nerve endings where animal meets angel, severed to create a surgical simulacrum. Perhaps the commodity has finally been defeated by a greater force, the image itself. The body has certainly fallen to its assault, writes a detransitioned 22-year-old woman, quote, I saw myself in the saucy lankiness of scruffy rock gods, the devil-may-care grins of thrill-seekers in films, the deep pain of confusion written on the faces of James Dean and Johnny Depp, but I could not see myself in any of the women I looked at. In the service of the image, and sundered from her body by sexual abuse, she had her breasts removed at age 17 and started taking testosterone, which nearly killed her. Which is more toxic, the chemicals injected to destroy one's natal sex, or the culture that makes that sex a prison? And why are women not allowed to ask that question? And an identity based on a hatred of the body, by definition, cannot be liberatory. Those soft animals are our only homes. Driven from our bodies, we are permanent refugees. There is nowhere else to go. The whole point of feminism is to stop the breakage, the incest, the rape, the battering, the so-called beauty practices that amount to a life of torture. That means we have to stop the ideology, too, the one that says men are human while women exist to be conquered and used, the one called gender. Measured by either sheer volume or effect, the ruling image of the age, the one delivering the ideology, is the pounding sadism of pornography. And the prison cell called woman grows ever smaller. Do not call that prison passé. What has been done to our bodies has been done to our planet. The sadist exerts his control. The necrophiliac turns the living into the dead. The self-willed and the wild are their targets, and their necrotic project is almost complete. Taken one by one, the facts are appalling. In my lifetime, the Earth has lost half her wildlife. Every day, 200 species slip into the longest night of extinction. Ocean is synonymous with the words abundance and plenty. Fullness is on the list, as well as infinity. And by 2048, the oceans will be empty of fish. Crustaceans are experiencing complete reproductive failure. In plain terms, their babies are dying. Plankton are also disappearing. Maybe plankton are too small and green for anyone to care about, but know this. 2 out of 3 animal breaths are made possible by the oxygen plankton produce. If the oceans go down, we go down with them. How could it be otherwise? See the pattern, not just the facts. There were so many bison on the Great Plains, you could sit and watch for days as a herd thundered by. In the Central Valley of California, the flocks of water birds were so thick they blocked out the sun. 1/4 of Indiana was a wetland, lush with life and the promise of more. Now it's a desert of corn. Where I live in the Pacific Northwest, 10 million fish have been reduced to 10,000. People would hear them coming for a whole day. This is not a story. There are people alive who remember it. And I have never once heard the sound that water makes when 40 million years of persistence makes its way home. Am I allowed to use the word apocalypse yet? The necrophiliac insists we are mechanical components, that rivers are an engineering project, that genes can be sliced up and arranged at whim, that our generative organs are fair game for the Foucauldian Frankensteins. He believes we are all machines, despite the obvious. A machine can be taken apart and put back together. A living being can't. May I add, neither can a living planet. Understand where the war against the world began. In maybe 12 places around the globe, humans took up the activity called agriculture. In very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and then you plant it to human use. Instead of sharing that land with the other million creatures who need to live there, you're only growing humans on it. It's biotic cleansing. The human population grows to huge numbers. Everyone else is driven into extinction. Agriculture creates a way of life called civilization. Civilization means people living in cities. What that means is they need more than the land can give. So food, water, energy have to come from somewhere else. It doesn't matter what lovely, peaceful values people hold in their hearts. The society is dependent on imperialism and genocide because no one willingly gives up their land, their water, their trees. But since the city has used up its own, it has to go out and get those from somewhere else. And that's the last 10,000 years in a few sentences. The end of every civilization is written into the beginning. Agriculture destroys the world. That's not agriculture on a bad day. That's what agriculture is. You pull down the forest, you rip up the prairie, you drain the wetland. Especially, you destroy the soil. Civilizations last between 800 and maybe 2,000 years. They last until the soil gives out. What could be more sadistic than control of entire continents? The sadist turns mountains into rubble, and rivers must do as they are told. The basic unit of life is violated with genetic engineering. The basic unit of matter as well, to make bombs that kill millions. This is his passion, turning the living into the dead. It's not just individual deaths, and not even the deaths of species. The process of life itself is now under assault, and it is losing badly. Vertebrate evolution has long since come to a halt. There isn't enough habitat left. There are areas in China where there are no flowering plants. Why? Because the pollinators are all gone. That's 500 million years of evolution. He wants it all dead. That's his biggest thrill, and the only way he can control it. According to him, he was never alive. There is no self-willed community, no truly wild land. It's all inanimate components he can arrange to his liking, a garden he can manage. Never mind that every land so managed has been lessened into desert. The essential integrity of life has been breached, and now he claims it never existed. He can do whatever he wants, and no one stops him. Can we stop him? I say yes, but then I have no intention of giving up. The facts as they stand are unbearable, but it's only in facing them that the pattern comes clear. Civilization is based on drawdown. It props itself up with imperialism, conquering its neighbors and stripping their land, but eventually even the colonies wear out. Fossil fuel has been an accelerant, as has capitalism, but the underlying problem is much bigger than either. Civilization requires agriculture, and agriculture is a war against the living world. Whatever good was in the culture before, 10,000 years of that war has turned it necrotic. But what humans do, they can stop doing. Granted, every institution is headed in the wrong direction. There's no material reason the destruction must continue. The reason is political. The sadist is rewarded, and rewarded well. Most leftists and environmentalists see that. What they don't see is the central insight of radical feminism, his pleasure in domination. The real brilliance of patriarchy is right here. It doesn't just naturalize oppression, it sexualizes acts of oppression. It eroticizes domination and subordination, and then institutionalizes them into masculinity and femininity. Men become real men by breaking boundaries. The sexual boundaries of women and children, the cultural and political boundaries of indigenous people, the biological boundaries of rivers and forests, the genetic boundaries of other species, and the physical boundaries of the atom itself. The sadist is rewarded with money and power, but he also gets a sexual thrill from dominating. And the end of the world is a mass circle jerk of autoerotic asphyxiation. The real brilliance of feminism is that we figured that out. What has to happen to save our planet is simple. Stop the war. If we just get out of the way, life will return, because life wants to live. The forests and the prairies will find their way back. Every dam will fail, every cement channel, and the rivers will ease their sorrows and meet the ocean again. The fish will know what to do. In being eaten, they feed the forest, which protects the rivers, which makes a home for more salmon. This is not the death of destruction, but the death of participation that makes the world whole. Sometimes there are facts that require all the courage we have in our hearts. Here is one. In 2015, global atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide reached 400 parts per million. For life to continue, that carbon needs to get back into the ground. And so we come to the grasses. Where the world is wet, trees make forests. Where it's dry, the grasses grow. Grasslands endure extreme heat in summer and vicious cold in winter. Grasses survive by keeping 80% of their bodies underground in the form of roots. Those roots are crucial to the community of life. They provide physical channels for rain to enter the soil. They can reach down 15 feet and bring up minerals from the rocks below, minerals that every living creature needs. They can build soil at an extraordinary rate. The base material they use to make soil is carbon, which means the grasses are our only hope to get that carbon out of the sky. And they will do it if we let them. If we could repair 75% of the world's grasslands, destroyed by the war of agriculture, in under 15 years, the grasses would sequester all the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. Read that again if you need to. Then take it with you wherever you go. Tell it to anyone who will listen. There is still a chance. The grasses can't do it alone. No creature lives independent of others. Repairing the grasslands means restoring the ruminants. In the hot, dry summer, life goes dormant on the surface of the soil. It's the ruminants who keep the nutrient cycle moving. They carry an ecosystem inside themselves, especially the bacteria that digest cellulose. When a bison grazes, she's not actually eating the grass. She's feeding it to her bacteria. The bacteria eat the grass, and then she eats the bacteria. Her waste then water and fertilize the grasses, and the cycle is complete. Civilization consumes the circle, so all civilizations end in collapse. How could it be otherwise, if your way of life relies on destroying the place you live? Now the soil is gone, and the oil is running out. By avoiding the facts, we are ensuring it will end in the worst possible way. We can do better than mass starvation, failed states, ethnic strife, misogyny, petty warlords, and the dystopian scenarios that collapse brings. It's very simple. Reproduce at less than replacement numbers. The problem will take care of itself. And now we come to the girls. What drops the birth rate universally is raising the status of women. Very specifically, the action with the greatest impact is teaching a girl to read. When women and girls have even that tiny bit of power over their lives, they choose to have fewer children. Yes, women need birth control, but what we really need is liberty. Around the world, women have very little control over how men use our bodies. Close to half of all pregnancies are unplanned or unwanted. Pregnancy is the second leading cause of death for girls aged 15 to 19. Not much has changed since Emmeline Pankhurst refused to give up. We should be defending the human rights of girls because girls matter. As it turns out, the basic rights of girls are crucial to the survival of the planet. Can we stop him? Yes, but only if we understand what we're up against. The sadist wants the world dead. Anything alive must be replaced by something mechanical. He prefers gears, pistons, and circuits to soft animal bodies, even his own. He hopes to upload himself into a computer someday. He wants the world dead. He enjoys making it submit. He's erected giant cities where once were forests. Concrete and asphalt tame the unruly. He wants the world dead. Anything female must be punished permanently. The younger they are, the sooner they break. So he starts early. A war against your body is a war against your life. If he can get us to fight the war for him, we'll never be free. But feminists said every woman's body was sacred. And we meant it, too. Every creature has her own physical integrity, an inviolable whole. It's a whole too complex to understand, even as we live inside it. I had no idea why my eyes were swelling and my lungs were aching. The complexities of keeping me alive could never be left to me. Being alive is a gift, the only gift. That soft animal body is all you have, and it needs your defense here at the end of the world. Refuse to fight his war on the terrain of your flesh. Fight him instead. We're going to have to match his contempt with our courage. We're going to have to match his brute power with our fierce and fragile dreams. And we're going to have to match his bottomless sadism with a determination that will not bend and will not break and will not stop. And if we can't do it for ourselves, we have to do it for the girls in the grasses. Look, whatever you love, it is under assault. But love is a verb. May that love call us to action.